Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. Very happy to be back and recording and very grateful to deserve some of your time. Thank you for having me and my guests in your ear. This episode features Peter Mantis of Logos LP. That is L-O-G-O-S-L-P. You can find him and his team at logoslp.com. Anyway, Peter stops by to educate us a little bit about the life sciences industry, and I found it to be an incredibly fascinating episode to prepare for. I am somewhat embarrassed that it has not been an area that I have focused on in the past, but better late than never. An interesting thing about these businesses is they're very M&A focused. If you look at McKinsey's book on valuation, you will see the following paragraph. It says, "For some industries, the differences in return with and without goodwill are even bigger than shown here. For the life sciences and technology sectors, for example, returns on capital, including goodwill, were around 25% versus 65% without goodwill." That should give you some indication of where you may want to spend some time when you decide to research, should you decide to research. Anyway, regardless, I think it's a fascinating industry. And again, the research prepping for this episode was very fun. This episode is featured by the one and only DeLupa. DeLupa is founded by a former hedge fund analyst to bring simplicity into the investment process. DeLupa offers an AI-driven single source for all company-reported data and allows for investment teams to make the most informed decisions in the shortest amount of time. DeLupa scales the velocity of an investment team's idea gen. Analysts spend less time locating and manually inputting meaningful disclosures into Excel and more time synthesizing in the minutes after the print. DeLupa captures data from all company-reported sources, including footnotes, MD&As, and investor presentations. DeLupa's data sheets include gap to non-gap adjustments, guidance, and all company-specific KPIs. Each data point is auditable to the source for easy verification and accuracy. DeLupa's Excel plugin can also update your existing models for the latest quarter in just a single click. Bulge bracket banks and major multi-managers are trusting DeLupa for use in initiating coverage, building and maintaining industry dashboards, and keeping their models up to date. Visit DeLupa.com/businessbrew to create a free account and learn more about how DeLupa can help increase your team's speed to differentiated insight. Whew, that is a mouthful. What does DeLupa do for me? In preparation and after this episode, I have been looking at Thermo Fisher. DeLupa's Excel spreadsheet has every data point that Thermo Fisher has disclosed, and I can click each cell. It brings me directly to the source information, an issue that has caused me some problems when reading and looking at Thermo is the difference that they cite between organic growth and core organic growth. I was able to easily sort through those differences by clicking on DeLupa's spreadsheets. Would it have been possible by printing out every single filing and figuring out exactly what was going on? Yes, that would have been possible. However, I saved a bunch of time with DeLupa, and time is money. DeLupa saves me time. DeLupa makes you money. That's how it works. May or may not turn you into the best analyst in history. Hasn't done that to me yet, but I'm looking forward to that day. Anyway, I will let this episode start, and I will just say that everything in this episode is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing in this show is, has, or ever will be investment advice. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions. Do your own due diligence, and it's good to be back. Here's the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, excited to be joined by Peter Mantis today. Peter, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, brother?
I'm pretty good, man. I was prepping for this in part by listening to your interview with Brandon Bielow, and I will highly suggest that people listen to that if they'd like some background information on you.
Yeah, Brandon's a great guy.
It was a solid pod.
Yes, I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I think that your approach is very interesting. If it's okay, I'd kind of like to dive, you know, I follow you on Twitter. I followed you for a long time, and I've been popping into some spaces that you've been speaking in. And, you know, I think it's one thing to hear, hey, you know, small cap or a sector is bombed out. But it's another thing to listen to you talk about how quality focused you are on businesses, and then also make sort of be table pounding at the moment about how small and biotech specifically is really in a poor way sentiment wise. And the reason that I say that is, you know, it's a lot of things are cheap for a reason, but I don't think that you're the type of guy who is too enamored with cheap just statistically. I think when you say cheap, you mean cheap relative to quality. So that's the start of why we had our first phone call, and curious to hear your thoughts of how I'm opening this up.
Yeah, I think it's great. I actually listened to a recent podcast you had with Mario Sabelli, talking about small caps too, and he's kind of preaching sort of from the same choir that I am. I want to caveat by saying, you know, people always look at the Russell 2000, but like there's a lot of garbage in that index. You know, I'm not talking about the financials, the energies, the price takers. I like looking at price makers and quality. So, you know, just like you look at evaluate any other business with high returns on capital or companies with high EBITDA margins, high gross margins, a lot of that, there's a lot of companies, or not a lot, but there are companies that are small or micro that also have those elements, and they're just getting whacked at the moment. You know, especially if you're in micro cap land or nano cap land, it's just outrageous. So yeah, I think the opportunities for that basket or bucket, I don't want to say that all small caps are screaming value. Like if rates are elevated for some time and the discount rate goes up, then, you know, like the multiples they may get are deserved. But I just think some of the other stuff that's super high quality, that's also that also might be facing idiosyncratic risks or situations or unusual circumstances, are really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what I mean when I say that I find it interesting that Mario's another guy. Mario Sabelli understands quality businesses and whatnot. And I, you know, there's enough people circling and saying the same thing that I can't help but see it a little bit myself. But, you know, the eyes deceive what's the goal of the market is to humiliate the most amount of people possible. So it's doing a good job thus far.
That's right. I will say, like, it's pretty, I don't want to say I've been shocked, but I would say that it is a little bit surprising the bloodbath that's going on. Only because the market right now, and it's probably, you could argue, last 2 years is kind of ignoring fundamentals for a lot of companies, for a lot of quality companies, especially if they're smaller, on the smaller end. And they're trading at multiples that I don't understand, quite frankly, you know, because how can you have the Mag 7 trade at one end of the curve and then with declining fundamentals, arguably, and some of these other companies which don't have risks of liquidity, don't have debt, you know, they have good margins, could potentially like trade at, you know, one time sales or less, and we're not talking about a shitco, we're talking about you know, quality company. So it just seems that liquidity has just been sucked right out of the whole sector. And like, what I find interesting is this is so like
we should pivot this entire pod and we should just talk about the Fed. That's what we should do. We should blame the Fed for all of the things that are going on in liquidity.
I know, but it's just made the Mag 7, I would say, very expensive. Like I don't know how one can generate, you know, double-digit IRRs from here in some of those companies.
Well, they got to grow. They got to grow for a while, and you can't have too much multiple compression. That's how the math works, right?
So, yeah. But even if you look at the XBI, okay, it's usually a proxy for duration rates. The last time the 10-year was this high, 06, 07, XBI was up 22% for the year. So it's
okay.
An interesting. That's where I'm. We're starting.
All right. Well, let me. So, okay. So, where were rates coming from back in that time?
So they were kind of, I don't remember exactly, but
and the reason that I'm actually asking this is, you know, I think if I wanted to put on my critical hat here, I'd say, okay, well, back then there was a cost capital for research. So maybe right now the XBI is full of companies that started their research 2 or 3 years ago or even longer when the cost of capital was super low. So their pipelines are garbage. So therefore they deserve these multiples.
Yeah, there is some
as a basket.
Yeah, there is some of that. I would say that there is a bit more earlier stage stuff in the XBI, but that's always sort of been the case. I guess what's interesting about this period is I think there's like a three-prong issue here. You have in 2021, you had a lot of preclinical stuff come to market, and usually that's not good for the XBI long term. Like you don't want to have a lot of preclinical companies coming IPOing at like 700 million valuations. Like it's just insane.
Okay, and preclinical, for those that don't know, is defined as what? You're not even in phase one. You're just a research company.
It's like you and I, you know, in a lab at a university, effectively, you know, I don't want to be that crude, but like,
yeah,
it's like here's some data and here's some research and like we're not even testing on people yet. It's just like straight up, here's some models, you know. And you had a record number trading at, you know, coming in at like 700 million and 500 million, 800 million in like 2021 valuations, which is nuts. So that bubble's been completely deflated. Right?
Yeah.
But now that rates are a bit high, you know, you have a record number of biotechs that are trading below cash. I think it's like half or close to half trading below cash. Not every one of them is preclinical. Like there's some phase one, two, three. So the market's just not giving them any benefit of the doubt. Right. They're saying
my intern just sent me rates, by the way, just going back. And rates were a little bit higher, but it looks like in 03 to 05, they were relatively low relative to history. So I don't know that the counter argument that I gave you stands up. I don't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted to get that data point. I mean, you know, it's that said, man, we were coming off of a very low rate environment over the past couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Definitely.
All right. I apologize for interrupting you.
No.
So getting back to kind of like what interested me talking to you is, one, you don't traffic in these preclinical, you know, names for the most part, or at all, I should say. Two, you have a very interesting take on the Inflation Reduction Act and what it's going to do to drug pricing. And three, I think you have, perhaps because I don't know the industry that well, but I think it's closer to reality that you have compelling arguments for the tool makers and some of these quality businesses that have, or maybe babies thrown out with the bathwater. So, you know, that's kind of how I see it. And I don't know where you want to take that. I didn't mean to cut you off. I do apologize, but
no, it's all good.
The intern isn't great at timing, you know. Neither is the mouse on the wheel. Sometimes the intern is, his name is Bard. And then I have to go to his parent company. And, you know, it's funny. I was doing that the other day, man. And I Googled something that Bard said. And Bard flat out was like, there is no source for this. And I was like, that's amazing.
You get it wrong.
Yeah. Well, or you thought of it yourself, but at least you told me you just made it up. And here's a computer making up stuff. So, If the back end of this podcast leaves a little to be desired, I hope that Google fixes it.
That's right.
So anyway, you want to talk a little bit about the Inflation Reduction Act to sort of start this and because I do think that potentially ties into the XBI being down so much, right? Because it creates this overhang on funding and whatnot.
Let's take it even a step back. I'll tell you the sort of environment that we're in right now. And it's not just the XBI. It's going to apply to IBB. It's going to apply to life science companies. So in 2020 to 2022, you've had record number of biotech funding. You've had obviously rates quite low, a lot of preclinical assets coming to market, frothy valuations, bubble territory. But over that 2 year span, let's say, you've had a couple of other things that have impacted biotech as well. So the first being you have the IRA that's passed by Biden. That impacts not just biotech, but big pharma. You had the NHP fiasco that's going on with the Biden administration. So this is for non-human primate research, which is the source of preclinical research in the United States. Then you obviously have high rates and just, you know, a really, really bad sentiment. The fourth thing is this COVID overhang. So you've had companies like Thermo and, you know, Danaher and West Pharmaceuticals. These are like S&P 500 components that saw a major boom to ramp up, you know, a couple billion in vaccines. But a lot of companies, especially in pharma, have been destocking, or in biotech have been destocking. So you have elevated inventories that need to come out into the market. And so that's impacting revenue growth in the short term for some of these big, quote unquote, picks and shovel companies. So if you combine all of those things together, you have this sort of record bloodbath in the XBI. In biotech, life science, I'm going to put it all together. Obviously, XBI is a bit more volatile because of more early stage companies, but I'm just talking generally from a life science perspective. They're all kind of in the shitter, right? Like, I think Thermo Fisher is going to have, if it stays here, it'll be like a third consecutive year of negative returns, which is like, you know, 5, 6, 6, 6 sigma. It's never happened. You know, it's a rare event. So like, that's kind of what's sort of bringing everything down. So talking about the IRA, why is it negative for biotech research? Like, long story short, it's costing more and more money to bring a drug to market, and the returns on that capital are getting lower and lower and lower, right? Patent cliffs are becoming quicker. There's more competition. There might even be miscalculation of what the market might be. So if you and I wanted to start a drug company, we're going to spend a couple billion dollars, like a biotech, let's say. And then we'd have to figure out what's the patient population. We'd have to figure out our spend on trials. Obviously, there's going to be hiccups along the way. And then at the end of all that, it could be 10 years. We estimate what that market might be, what the patient population would be, what our return on our capital would be. And sometimes that return is not greater than the amount that you invested. And so what the IRA does, it stifles innovation, because if I can't price the drugs that I need to price to make a return on that investment, then pharma is not incentivized to innovate. Not incentivized to do the preclinical research, not incentivized to do the low-end stuff, and it impacts biotech funding. And for a lot of companies, the preclinical stuff is starting at the university level. It's like research, it's like really important stuff that's going on at that level. The other thing that's sort of hurting that group is the NIH budget cuts. NIH is really important for research, really important for grants. I mean, this is like national security level kind of stuff, right? This is like, if you want to stifle science in the United States, just, you know, do the following things that the Biden administration has done, basically. And so that's sort of what's added to the pressure with the life science sector and the biotech sector, and in addition to the macro and the rates.
So when I was reading about the Inflation Reduction Act, the drugs, I believe that what they can, what's the big, is it Medicare Part D or whatever that can start now negotiating drug prices down as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act? Is that accurate?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And I think that it's like 9 years in that they can start to really negotiate the drug prices. So I was wondering, is the calculus on the drug companies part actually, okay, well, we just need to raise prices even higher in the front years in order to recoup our cost? And what it appears to me is that the big drug companies now are more acquisition focused than they are R&D focused, yes, than anything.
Yeah, so, I think you can see some of that, definitely. It's just because the failure rate is so high in this sector, pharma, biotech, life science, it's so, so egregiously high that you're getting to a point where the more you stifle their ability to innovate, the less risk they'll take. And sometimes risk in that industry is good. You want to know what will work, what won't work, what might fail, what lessons can be learned. And if the more pressure you put on that group. I mean, look, you know, at some point, drugs all come, the price starts to decline as patent cliffs hit.
Yeah.
And so it's just a natural ecosystem that goes through cycles. And, you know, patents last for 20 years, but they take a long time to develop. And the clock starts ticking the moment it's developed. So
yeah.
The problem you have is if you're going to stifle that like early end research, then they're not interested in things that they think will have high failure rates or things that might be really risky, which might require a lot of capital. Like if you wanted to solve a really big issue like Parkinson's, you're going to need a lot of capital. You're going to need a big trial and it's going to cost you a lot of money. And it's a very difficult thing to solve. So that's where it becomes more risk.
So would you attribute that more to the NIH funding cuts than the Inflation Reduction Act?
It's like a 1-2 punch, you know. Imagine you're in a boxing match, you're getting hit on the side of NIH, and other side with IRA. It all kind of comes down. NIH is like, oh, that's direct. Like, you're not getting funding for this critical Alzheimer's research, right? But, you know, pharma is the biggest source of pharma funding, biotech funding. Like, these guys have so much cash, right? And they're all facing patent cliffs. So I guess that's a green shoot, which is despite the IRA and the NIH, pharma is facing the greatest patent cliff in the history of mankind. Like, never in the history of the world have they seen $500 billion in patents disappear by 2031, 32. So they're going to have to spend money, like, soon, right? Even Ozempic, which is a hit drug, you know, that was developed, like, it's not that new. Like, it was developed for over a decade.
It's a diabetes medication, right?
Yeah. So it's going to hit a patent cliff sooner, Mounjaro too. And they need to innovate. So they're going to spend a ton of money. And they have pharma has the best distribution network in the world. So
are they going to spend it on the acquisitions or are they going to spend it on R&D? Because it seems to me that the efficiency of R&D in big pharma has substantially declined. And I understand that part of the reason is shareholders didn't really want them to focus on R&D as a core competence. For a little while. At least some of the companies, it appears, have kind of given up that. They're more of an acquisition machine than an R&D machine.
Yeah, I think you'll see more acquisitions. But they want to see viability, you know, especially if you go phase two and up. So the thing is, like, when you go for a drug, let's say you want to go for a rare disease, like, I'm going to use Parkinson's, right? Usually phase one is like 10, 12 patients. But then you go to phase two and it's 10 times that. I guess like 100 patients or 200 patients. So, and then on phase three, it's like 1,000, 3,000 patients. So you got more data, you got more proof, you got more resiliency in the robustness of what you think this thing might do. And so you kind of de-risk it to a degree. And if you can get those at like less than cash, right? That'd be interesting for pharma, obviously, depending on the research and that.
Yeah. You know. All right. So you're saying, if like a company like MaxCyte right now is super small, do your own work, but trading what I think the market cap's below cash, right?
I think the enterprise value is like,
yeah,
pretty close.
Okay.
Like 70% of their market caps in cash right now.
So if you're some other, that's closer to a tool maker than pharma though, right?
Yeah. Or am I so wrong on that? Clear, I don't typically buy pure biotech.
Okay.
Look at the trends and I like the compounder businesses, the quality businesses that can compound earnings for a really long time. And so that's typically companies that sell to pharma. You know, pharma is the biggest profit pool in the world. And the companies that sell to pharma are, in my opinion, some of the best businesses in the world. So that's where I more focus on.
And if you can find one of those quality businesses and you're taking it out at a reasonable multiple, and by the way, it's got a ton of cash on the balance sheet, you're sort of probability of that acquisition going terribly is probably a lot lower than maybe other acquisitions. Do you want to talk a little bit about why these businesses are so good? I was having this conversation yesterday, and the moat created by the regulatory process and citing some of these tool makers in the approvals is very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a good friend of mine. He had a good quote. He's like, find the company to sell the pharma, not the hospitals. And the main reason for that is the pricing power and the value chain. So I could just walk you through like really high level. For a lot of these companies, let's take MaxCyte, for example. They're in sort of like allowing companies to create next gen cell therapy. So a major cell therapy approval is coming at the end of the year is exa-cel for sickle cell. This is for sickle cell disease. CRISPR and Vertex partnered to create this new drug. And you know, the AdCom is on Halloween, ironically, but it's meant to be game changing. This is a game changing therapy, right? And if it's approved, it'll be the first ever cell therapy in the United States for that disease. And so why are these companies really interesting? Is because when you go and you develop these drugs, you're integral into the supply chain of the pharmaceutical company. Everything is clocked by the FDA, right? So you go from like your clinical trials, everything's got clocked by the FDA. What syringe did you use to? What was the dosage to all this data you collect on the patient? And then as a pharmaceutical manufacturer, you know, you need to test out your manufacturing capabilities too. You can't just like all of a sudden start making, you know, Tylenol pills from nothing, right? You have to have something called a pilot facility. And Thermo's building a bunch of pilot facilities now, but effectively a pilot facility is kind of like a test track for a car. Like, you do whatever you want there to manufacture to see if you can improve your process. Because then once you get to something called a cGMP facility, that's like you're locked in. You can't change anything. Like FDA will come in and shut you down if they find any problem, like dust on the ground, you know, like process parameters are not good, et cetera. So because these things are such locked in the FDA from like, you know, the what's used in the clinic to what's used in manufacturing, et cetera, these guys have effectively a regulatory moat, right? And so if you look at companies like a MaxCyte or a West or a Danaher or a Thermo, that's where these guys get such great pricing power, is that they're locked in. Like if you're using Cytiva, which is Danaher, for bioprocessing, let's say you're using particular tubes or chromatography columns to create cells, you cannot change that. If you're going
Yeah,
to
it's actually in the approval. Like, we
Yeah.
use this equipment. And if
Correct.
you try to change the equipment, you've got to go get a new approval.
Exactly. So you have this value chain plus regulatory capture. That's really tough to move.
This is how you get multi-$1,000 plastic bags.
That's right, exactly. And then that's what people don't understand. If they look at like a Sartorius or a Repligen or Thermo, they're literally selling you plastic bags and pieces of metal and tubing for tens of thousands of dollars because they can, right?
Well,
That
so, and then the logical question is, why does this continue?
problem with pharma is that they don't want to engage in any risk, right? And so when you have companies like Thermo, which is effectively too big to fail, or Danaher, which is effectively too big to fail now after the spinoff, or companies like MaxCyte or other ones that may be smaller, but they're integral and a really important piece, you don't want to take on that risk and do anything in-house. They say, I'll pay whatever I want. I'll pay whatever you ask because I want to make sure that this gets to market. Because every day that drug's not on market impacts terminal value. And so if you are a company, let's say you have a gene therapy, you know, that's going to be $1 million plus or $500,000 a year per dose, right? The margins are going to be the 90%. So I want to get that as quick as I can to market, as you know, to make sure that I attack the market because my patent clock is ticking.
And I guess that the competence of manufacturing that the drug company has is at drug manufacturing, and the competence that Thermo has is at the components of, I mean, I guess the real way that they could maybe acquire the competence is to actually go out and acquire something like Thermo, but then you're talking about a $250 billion acquisition or something like that. Like, the probability that I think is
Yeah,
lowish.
the pharma is kind of like how do I? Their core competency is twofold: it's distribution and science, right? Like these guys have major databases similar to Constellation Software. With here, every single drug company is public that we're interested in, and you know what's the science looking like? They're spending their time on making sure that these things get through the approval process. Maybe there's an attractive acquisition candidate, and like what are the commercial regulations I need to abide by? Right, at least these companies have huge regulatory teams. for just for the drugs, right? For labeling, for packaging, for all these other things. And they have distribution networks that are massive, and they have massive facilities. Some of the smaller drug companies, they may outsource the manufacturing because they're like, I can't handle the risk. I can't do it. I actually cannot do it. So then you have companies like Lonza, Catalent, et cetera. Even some small companies might even outsource to Merck. Merck has a very large manufacturing, contract manufacturing business in Germany. Right. And so if you're a drug company, I'm going to ride the coattails of Merck distribution and manufacturing. So I don't, you know, I don't screw it up. Right. I don't have any problems.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Because to your point, if you start, let's say you're in a trial and somehow you hit a manufacturing snag, the amount of money that you're forgoing does not make, it's crazy, basically,
it's not
right?
That. You get, the FDA can shut it down for months.
Yeah.
Find you, and like, it's just a big problem. And these things are not cheap to build. They're like, you know, $1 billion or 500 million, depending on the size, depending on the drug, depending on everything.
Yeah, small and mission critical with regulatory capture.
Right. So a company like MaxCyte, for example, they have something called flow electroporation. Effectively, think of like a piece of equipment that puts a shock into a cell and that can deliver that cell to cure something like sickle cell disease or potentially maybe.
Yeah, it gives it the charge that enables it to bind or something like that. Is that what it does?
High level.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they've got like 130 patents on it, et cetera. But the key kicker here in that business is they know they got the top stuff. No one has really come close to competing with them. So their gross margins are like 90%. But because they know that they're sort of integral to the business, they're like, oh, if you discover something on our platform, we'll take a low single digit royalty on a drug. And so that backlog now is close to $2 billion, right? And market cap is like, what, $300 million. So, and if you believe that cell therapy is a real area, I think it's a real area. For a number of rare diseases, then, you know, that number is going to continue to grow. Those partners are going to continue to grow. And if you have an event like this approval for sickle cell, then you have a funding catalyst. Then you have a proven model. It's like, okay, like that's an immediate re-rate on the company because not only have you proven you're integral to finding a, you know, potentially a drug that can generate billions of dollars, but the entire biotech community and venture capital community is like, oh, like I want my portfolio of companies to look like that. I want them to, you know, get approved as well for their cell therapy assets. So there'll be demand, and it's just, it's more of a precedent setting. And that's why approvals are really important by the FDA in the United States, is because they set precedents. And when you set a precedent, it sets a funding precedent for the ecosystem. Pharma gets a little more de-risked, they get more comfortable acquiring. You know, take Repligen, for example. This thing literally did 40-50 times since 2014 on the backs of just rising amount of approvals in gene therapy every year, right? We're having like maybe one gene therapy approved every year from 2017. Now it's like five a year, so, or more. Like, and they're expected to be dozens. So that's where you can also get really, really strong businesses, because these companies, once they're locked in, they have pricing power. And once you're an approved drug, you can't change it.
Right? What does Repligen do? I should know this.
They compete with Danaher and Thermo. So they're kind of, again, they're kind of in that business that sells metal tubes and columns and, you know, software and plastic bags for biologics and cell and gene therapy manufacturing, right? Like when you're, the sort of trend that's going on in pharma right now is we're going from a world that treats symptoms that to treats, like actually gives legit cures. And so,
yeah, how does the world deal with that? It always seems like the drug dealers make their money on the comeback.
That's right. So this is why, like, if you have a legitimate, you know, cure for sickle cell, it's going to be a couple million dollars drug, because it's a one-time dose, and like effectively you could be cured of sickle cell disease, or if you have Alzheimer's, right? Like theoretically, someone, you know, one of these companies could develop a cell therapy that literally cures Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. I think we're a little bit far away from that, but my point is that there are legitimate, there's you're, like you're a new person, right?
Yeah.
So a case in point is,
I mean, is that a risk? Is a risk to all these theses that basically, you know, that I know this is crazy, but a logical conclusion of developing a ton of cures is eventually there's no need for more research. I mean, I guess there's always new things that pop up, but it's like, do you actually cure the world so your terminal value goes down like crazy?
I think that's
which like would be very odd.
Yeah, so that's a long way away. But for example, it might be like, oh, you have late stage Parkinson. I can't cure Parkinson's like the time you originally got it, but I can. Here's cell therapy that can effectively really reduce a lot of the major symptoms for late stage Parkinson's. And maybe there's another therapy for mid and like early. And like, so, you know, sometimes there's just
Alzheimer's would be nice, man. Watching my grandma fall was, you know, I mean, it was wild. There were like step downs, right? It was like slow, then quick. And then it'd be kind of nice to that said, I don't know, you know, eventually the body hurts so much. Maybe the mind doesn't want to know it's around, but we'll see.
What I find interesting for this sort of world that we're shifting to is twofold. First is what will happen in generics? Because the thing with the cell and gene therapy is you have to follow up with the patient for 5, 10, 20 years. Is a generic manufacturer going to do that? One. Two is how are you going to develop this? Right? Like, how are you going to manufacture? Like, some of these processes are really, really sophisticated. Like MaxCyte, for example, they're literally taking blood out of a human being, putting it, you know, using their process, putting it back into the patient, dosing it. Like, it's a very physical thing. It's like, it's very much in your face. And drug manufacturers, what they like to do is like, they would love like an Ozempic, right? Going like, you take two shots a day and I'm out of your hair. Right.
Yeah.
But a lot of these.
Well, yeah, because to your point, they're a distribution game, right? They want it distributed, get it out there. You follow your own protocol. And by the way, if you don't, maybe we'll sell you a few more, right?
Exactly,
that's not the end of the world for
them.
So
maybe the generics are like, I'm not interested in that segment of, you know, the drug market. The other thing is insurance. Like, is United Health going to pay for a one-time shot that cures Parkinson's for everybody? Let's say you have a cure for Parkinson's. Right? Maybe the answer is, yeah, I'll pay billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars to cure because I don't have to deal with the constant cost down the road. Maybe that's what happens.
Yeah, you would have to MPV what the general cost of Parkinson's is and then say, okay, well, once this is positive, that's what we'll do. You get into a lot of weird philosophical sort of questions, right? Like with some of these orphan type diseases, is it worth it for society I guess this exists in orphan drugs too, but it's just kind of interesting. You start to make judgments about people's health once economics enters the picture. And I'm not even sure it's wrong to make those judgments, but it doesn't, I'm glad I don't have to make them is maybe the right way to say it.
Yeah, no, it's tough. And it also brings into question, like, how will that change legacy pharma's portfolio? I mean, the way to think about pharma is, like, these guys are like musical chairs. One year, it's Lilly. Okay, in 5 years, there'll be some other, you know, one of the other big seven, maybe Pfizer, maybe AstraZeneca, maybe Novartis. And then 5 years from there, it'll be a GSK. Like, they all kind of just rotate. Every one of them will eventually have some kind of hit that will just crush it, right?
So maybe you buy pharma when it's out of favor, like when it's the worst of the group, and you just say, well, eventually they're going to hit it out of the park.
that's not a bad way to think about it. Or ones that have like really good promising portfolios that are like phase 1, phase 2, you know, because they'll have the resources to bring it to market. You don't have to worry about
that. Well, it's almost like the big private equity firms, right? Like they're so big, they're going to eventually they're going to buy a drug that works. I would think.
Exactly. So. But yeah, so I focus on the life science compounders. I think they're set up for the sort of secular wave where you have really expensive one-time dosage of a particular therapy, which could legitimately lead to a cure. And manufacturing is going to be really important because you cannot make a mistake there, right? You cannot make a mistake when you're injecting somebody with some kind of cell and gene therapy. And usually these cell and gene therapies, so if you're cell therapy, these aren't pills. These are like syringes going into your body, infusions, right? So the margins for a lot of these companies are going to be really high. Like if you take West Pharmaceuticals, for example, they have a segment of their business. This is S&P 500 component. They have a business called HVP, which is sort of like their high value product business. That's for like the COVIDs, the biologics, the Ozempics, the, you know, the cell and gene therapies, right? So those things are going to be 50% gross margin, 40% EBITDA margin, right? Like this is, we're talking near Visa, I wouldn't say Visa, but very high quality companies, and they're going to command premium multiples. They're going to command 35 times, 40 times EBITDA.
Why is West so relatively strong year to date? What happened? It looked like 2022, they really sold off, yeah, and then people woke up.
GLPs. They own 90% okay. of the biologics market. So like every time you take
that'll answer.
You're taking a syringe, you're gonna hire West. So
interesting, yeah, because they're the one deviant from the group generally, right, that has had like strong year to date performance.
Yeah. The headwind to them is if someone comes out with a pill for Ozempic Mounjaro, like a GLP, and that pill has to be packaged. It will be packaged by West, but that's a lower margin product for West. Like West is transitioning to their HVP line, which is really high end syringes, stoppers, plungers, etc., that you're going to need to infuse a cell therapy. And they're kind of preparing their business for that cell and gene therapy world, right? So you might see like a couple quarters where like, oh, Ozempic is off market and Mounjaro, so we're going to, and some, maybe Pfizer came up with a pill. Maybe it's a bit of a headwind to margin, but we're talking about long term. They should be as large as big pharma, like over time, like 100 billion plus market cap, right? Like they control effectively, not control, I mean, they have 90% market share in biologic drugs and the delivery of those drugs. So.
God, that's so beautiful when you think about it from a business standpoint.
It's arguably, people talk about like, you know, Moody's, S&P, Google, it's like Mount Rushmore of businesses. For me, Wes is up there. Like, here's the thing with West. The moment you try a drug, like you go from clinical trials, you got to list how you can deliver it. You need syringe, you need a vial, you know what's going on here. And you can't change it. You cannot change your phase two. You can't change phase three, right? And then once it's commercial, you're locked in. You're locked in for life, right? And even when this thing goes generic, what is a generic manufacturer going to do? They're going to go do a generic retrial because they didn't like the syringe? No.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
Don't get to it, right? And so like the margins on these things are very, very big, and they add services on top of that at 90% gross margins. Like I got to make sure, hey, you got a syringe.
What the heck is, what's buzzing in the background? What do you have going on there?
It's my email. Sorry about that.
You got a beeper?
I should get one.
Yeah, man.
Maybe we'll just silence it out actually.
It's all right. Oh, we got to look at the office. I like
it. That's right.
A real candid look. Nice.
That's right.
So how do you think of like how West compares to like Danaher and Thermo? Like, is it, because they all seem to be quite strong from a business quality standpoint.
Yeah, Danaher is sort of transitioning into more of a downstream biologics company. So they recently spun up the environmental business. They're like, hey guys, take this to market and we'll take the cash and double down on biologics, effectively Cytiva, which is what they bought
from
healthcare. So when you're making cells...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to... I said, yeah, when you talked. You said effectively Cytiva, which they bought from...
GE Healthcare. GE.
Okay.
They bought it in like 2020. So they're betting the farm on the sector, right? How they differ is West is sort of like to the patient, and Danaher is more in the manufacturing. So like cross-analytic software plus like garbage bags and piping and things like that. Which is very critical. Thermo, the way I think about Thermo is like it's a shopping mall for pharma, right? It's like end to end, whatever you want, they got, and they're going to take care of you, right? Danaher has some pieces that are like that, but it's more downstream, so more like a Repligen and a more like a Sartorius. So again, inventing and bioprocessing of those drugs, processing of the drugs.
When you know, when I look at these, and my consensus feed may be wrong, but you know, like I look at Thermo and I hear what you're saying on the sentiment is bad, and it's a Six Sigma event that, you know, we're going through 3 years of no returns. But then I look and we're like at a 2 year out 4% free cash flow yield or something like that. And you know, how do you think about how much is too much to pay for a business like this? I mean, I think part of being in this Six Sigma 3 year of no return was a little bit of like things got ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, there's the number one trend that I want to figure out how to play, especially, you know, after helping my grandma, is it just really solidified what a wave of aging population we're going to have and how much. Like, it's one thing to read in data. It's, I guess, for me, another thing to experience. And I just think there is going to be such, you know, the boomers are massive as a population and they're aging into health problems. And it's about to come to the point where, I mean, maybe we're 5 to 10 years away, but like once they hit 75 to 85, dealing them drugs is going to be a beautiful business.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like real inflection time.
Yeah. You know, in terms of your question on free cash flow yields, it really depends on the business, but the more you really, like, that's going to be a function of, because of these businesses have immense regulatory capture, okay, and immense pricing power, it's not unusual for them to get to like sub one free cash flow yield, right? Like the historic norm for a lot of these companies, you know, like an Intuitive Surgical, for example, people are like, oh, it's never been cheap, right? Even in 2009 during the crash, it's never been cheap. This is when you're such integral part of this massive profit pool, as an example, it's not unusual to see like, oh, 0.3% free cash flow all the way to 2. Like that's sort of like where you see a lot of that stuff. And for, see a Danaher or a Thermo trading roughly, let's say, the 10-year on an unusual period of like high rates, is, you could argue that it's quite cheap. Because they're going to be compounding their earnings for double digits for quite a long time, right? These are very long markets. And I think people forget, they talk about growth. And the problem with a lot of these companies from a growth perspective is because they're so highly regulated, they do like 15% forever, right? It's not like AI where you might do 50%, 40%, or, you know, 60, 70% in a given year and then kind of tail off and maybe there's like a bump later on. It's because they're such locked in a supply chain and the FDA is so stringent, it's just sort of got this massive tailwinds, that massive like duration. So I think those valuations are not unreasonable considering the growth in the earnings.
Well, you know, what's funny is I like a lot of people that probably listen to this podcast, I read Ben Graham and then Buffett, and then I knew everything, right? Like I had no questions that I needed to ask anymore. And now, and I also, I read a couple of statistical books, so I really had all the answers. And what I'm now realizing is, man, you get a business like this. I mean, the index is an extremely tax efficient mechanism to invest through.
For sure.
If you decide not to go down that route, well, I'll personalize it. Forget about you. I'll say I. If I decide not to go down that route, it's very difficult to say like, well, you know, Thermo's trading at a 4% free cash flow yield 2 year out. This like, you know, I don't know, insert one random company that actually competes in capitalism is trading at a 12% free cash flow yield. Right. Like, isn't that 12% much cheaper would be what I would historically think. And I wasn't IRR enough focused and thinking about like what the true terminal value here is. And the terminal value protection is something that I wish that a younger me understood a lot earlier. Obviously, I mean, if you want to bet that the entire system changes, that's, I mean,
yeah,
I think good luck on that. But that fair. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, I think when you look at a free cash flow, I kind of look at it like an ROIC number, which is I need to dive a bit deeper into why, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, an oil company peak cycle of 40% ROIC is very different than a Danaher doing, or you know, or Constellation Software or one of these other companies with high gross margin that does 25 forever or 20% ROIC forever. And you want to figure out what exactly is the durability of the company, what markets are they participating in, what's the competition. Like you want to figure out all this. What's disruption risk, right? And so that's where you can get a little bit of that stickiness. So if you figure out that, hey, a 4% free cash yield for this kind of company is actually quite cheap versus the 10% free cash flow yield at this other one.
No, yeah,
I like to find
that's right.
the quality ones, because especially in life science, it's such a regulated industry, right? And the FDA is so tough, overly tough, right? That's another thing I forgot to mention too, which is, you know, last year, I think we didn't have an FDA head for like 12 months. So there's like a backlog of approval. I read a really interesting research report that suggested that the number of drugs currently sitting in phase three is at an all-time high, meaning like they're not going through, right? And some of these drugs are approved elsewhere. They're approved in Europe. You know, you might get a drug approved in Europe, and it could be 18 months, 2 years before it's in the United States or the FDA. You know, I'll just give you an example. So ClearPoint Neuro, one of the investors, and I know the company pretty quite well, they're have a drug that's for something called AADC deficiency, which effectively, if you really want to think about it, is Parkinson's for kids. It's children born without dopamine neurons. Okay. It's terrible.
No, that's sad.
Terrible. Like, these kids are zombies. They can't move. They can't walk. They get droopy. It's death sentence. It's terrible. Okay? It's a rare disease, genetic disease, but it's an awful disease. Okay. The drug that has been developed, gene therapy, is effectively created a new child. Like, we're talking about life changing. The kids are walking again. They're playing. They're, you know, they're having fun. They're smiling. They can eat, right? Because if you don't have dopamine, it affects your ability to react, to eat, to move, right? And it's been approved in Europe. This has been approved in Europe and Israel. And so you see these cases of these kids in Italy or in Poland or in Germany, and they're life-changing results. This still has not been approved by the FDA in the United States. Obviously, that will be a massive catalyst event for the company and for the cell therapy and gene therapy industry and ecosystem as well, because it's a re-rating event. But, you know, the FDA has also been a major backlog problem for a lot of these life-saving drugs. And that, again, impacts, you know, life science sector, biotech funding, biotech acquisitions. It impacts the entire group as a whole as well. So
it's a shame that we can't. I guess I need to understand why, from a policy perspective, we can't lead on.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I do have American families flying to Europe to, you know, different countries around the world to get a life-saving treatment for their child, right? And
yeah,
it's crazy. It's just now this drug is expensive too. Like, it's $3 million. You know, it's not a cheap drug. Insurance has been, especially governments in Europe, they've been open to paying for it or subsidizing it, because it's like, okay, like, this is life-threatening, right? So yeah, like, you know, we definitely need someone in the FDA to sort of wake up here.
This is where you get into the tough debates, right?
Yeah,
is any drug worth $3 million? But hopefully over time it comes down, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, this rare diseases, so it's a function of like rare disease risk, cost to invest, and typically the rarer, the more risk there is, because this is a more of a procedure. Like, a child has to go through a, you know, has to put a syringe in their brain effectively. They're asleep. So there's more risk, more cost, more potentially, you know, issues that could come arise from it. So yeah, like, they have to sort of recoup on that investment. And that's sort of like the world we're going into, where that's just the start. You know, there was a hemophilia drug that was passed this year. I think it's like $2.7 million, right? Gene therapy. So that's sort of like the prices you're going to get for a lot of these rare disease candidates. Like, if you get a Parkinson's, like a mid-level Parkinson's cell therapy, it's like going to be $4 million, $5 million. It's going to be a massive number, right? And insurance is going to be like, yeah, okay, like, maybe I'll pay it, because it'll cut my Parkinson's patient population by a tremendous amount, right?
Yeah, I guess I need to know how much insurance is paying in order to understand the pricing, but yeah. It's so tough, because, like, if it's your kid, right? If it's my kid, I'm obviously like, yeah, You did $3 million drug, $3 million drug, got to have it, right? But then I'm putting that cost onto society and asking society to say, yes, that's okay for my kid, right? It's
yeah. And to be fair,
I don't know, man, these are tough.
Some of these diseases are so rare, it's like 500 patients, maybe 1,000, right? So governments are much more easy to write a check for that. But for a certain, you know, if you have to fly your kid out to the UK to get this drug, and maybe it's not subsidized or partially subsidized, and you got to fork up like $500,000. Yeah, like that's the reality for a lot of these people. Like I would do it in a heartbeat, obviously, but you know, it's it does say something.
Assuming you can, right? Assuming a lot of people can't.
Yeah, for sure.
Most. Yeah, man. I don't. It's interesting. The other thing that I thought was interesting in this research, this has been a really fun podcast to prepare for, because it led me down sort of wormholes that I otherwise would not go down. And I actually texted some of my buddies in a media chat. I was like, why do we talk about media at all when there are these businesses out there? Like, what a waste of time. But anyway, such is my life. I was shocked to see how low as a percentage of overall healthcare costs the drugs are. I did not realize that with all the attention that drug prices get, I figured that it would be a much greater percentage of aggregate healthcare costs, and it's really not very big at all.
Yeah, it's not. Yep.
And then I was reading like what Congress is focused on with, like, you know, trying to stick it to the pharma companies, and I don't know. I kind of understand why politically it's palatable, but from like, is this really what we should be spending our time on? I'm not so sure.
Or even like, you know, the FTC coming in and questioning the Horizon Therapeutic deal with Amgen. I think it was Amgen. I mean, you just don't understand how pharmaceutical industry works if you're doing that, right? Like,
So explain that if you don't mind, because I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know. So I think the FTC was trying to stop Horizon Therapeutics deal being Horizon Therapeutics being acquired. I think it was from Amgen, and I think that's the first case I've seen for antitrust for any biotech or pharma, and it just sort of leaves. I don't know what's going on in government, but like, it's your peak incompetence, right? Like, I don't understand how you can apply antitrust to pharma because of patent cliffs. Like, you are literally have an expired milk carton that will die in 3 years, 4 years, maybe five. And there's no monopolistic enterprise here. This isn't like Microsoft buying Amazon or something like that. Like, this is like someone else will come in and will develop these drugs once the patents are done, right? So I don't know how you have these sort of FTC concerns with in anything pharma. And I think that's why it failed, in my opinion. And it was the only one that I've seen that was brought up by the FTC. But you need to have pharma actively buy companies and not have antitrust issues at all, or have an agenda around that, because that's like a major piece of innovation, right?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense.
These patents they all fall. Like,
it's not like Thermo buying another company that's within their core competence and then they basically have a monopolistic position. It's you're buying something that has a patent cliff and the FTC is suing to stop that.
Yeah it's like, yeah, this company is going to die in 3 years.
Yeah,
and maybe not die, but face incredible amount of competition. Yeah. And so it just doesn't make any sense to deal with that. You know, from an FTC perspective, you know, like, you and I can come up with some sort of like genetic editing platform tomorrow, right? And it's like, oh, that we're a real threat to XYZ. That's why biotech is such an incredibly difficult place to invest, because it's not, these are not companies that compound over time typically, right? They're very binary. It's like, oh, you got to prove you're up 500% on the day, right? Because like this, you either attack the market, you come up with an alternative drug to a major disease, or you're disrupting a current incumbent. And so it's like incredibly disruptive. It's the most anti-fragile sector in the markets today. It's like a forest fire. You know, they all get burnt to a crisp in environments like that. And then at some point they'll all come back, and they all come back down, and they all go up.
When you say anti-fragile, it sounds like you're describing something that's fragile.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I would say that like, it'll never go to zero. right? Like,
it's
but it's almost kind of like a forest fire that burns the soil and then eventually creates a new cycle and new trees come up and then those trees get burnt down, etc. Like, I don't know if you've seen purposefully burnt forests to sort of allow for good growth and allow for the ecosystem to thrive. But it's biotech is kind of like that, where like you have some periods, very large market caps, game-changing therapies, peak valuation, then they get slaughtered. It looks like they're going to zero, but they're not actually going to zero. And then they all come back again. It's just the nature of how they're disrupted, right? There's always someone trying to come up with something else to create a cure for some kind of disease. And that disruptive nature creates sort of like an anti-fragility to it. It's very hard to do antitrust when you're dealing with companies that could go to zero at any time.
Yeah. So when you're watching the XBI, is it fair to say that you are more interested in the XBI because of what it means for the usage of the people that sell into that ecosystem, as opposed to you're actually watching like the names in the ecosystem? I mean, I was just looking at it, and it seems like most of the names are development companies, not, you know, not the actual.
I follow the XBI, IBB. IBB is a bit higher quality, but it moves the same, give or take, you know. It's a good way to track sentiment, in my opinion. And if you overlay charts, just like go overlay, you know, like a thermo on the IBB or the XBI, they're moving kind of the same. Obviously, they're less volatile than the XBI. But if you just look at sort of the patterns, it's the same sort of thing.
It would make sense, because when the XBI is showing optimism, that means a lot of trials are going on. People are juiced. Thermo's probably getting a lot of orders, stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Definitely impacted by biotech funding. I don't really invest purely in biotech. Unless there's something absolutely unique that I might be interested in, you know, I might put on some kind of starter position or a very, very small amount of, you know, percentage of the portfolio. But I'm more interested in it from a, this is where sentiment is right now for this group facing a tailwind, a secular tailwind. And let me see how this interacts with some of these other great businesses that have pricing power, that have that regulatory capture, that are attacking that really large profit pool over time. And look, there's going to be companies in the XBI that do like 100 bags, 50 bags coming out of this. You know, like I think there's one this year, Cabo did like 25X, you know. So like you're going to see some of those companies do that. But I think that's too hard of a game, unless you're like, even if you're super specialized and MD, PhD, it's so hard to fish in that pond, right? There's so many variables that you have to consider. So it's tough. I stick more with the sort of compounders, life science compounders.
I said once on the Twitter machine that if I could cover anything, it would be biotech. But what I really meant by that is like, there's just so much interesting. There appears to me to be so many interesting things going on with treatment that it would be really cool to have that be my job. I almost more mean it as like, it'd be fun to write about rather than invest in.
Right.
Like, I think there's probably a lot easier games out there. And I'm certain that there are very good biotech investors. I don't mean to disparage them when I say that, but boy, like that seems like you're really earning your money.
Yeah.
Probably a good place to play if you can.
Yeah. Like if you're the Baker Brothers, you know, the big fund, and I think they're in New York. They're like the most famous, you know, most prestigious biotech fund. You know, it's tough for them, right? Like, They were big winners in Seagen. They've owned it since like 2004. That's like a rare to see a biotech company, you know, get added to NASDAQ 100 and, you know, compound kind of thing. Like that's a rare. So there are winners sometimes like that, like Regeneron, you know, or these other kinds of companies. But it's tough. It's very, very tough. So unless you have like a specialist who knows what they're doing, I don't recommend purely investing in that area, so to speak.
You mentioned Regeneron, which, unless I'm mistaken, it's all in the mice, and that reminded me of Charles River Labs. Do you mind talking a little bit about what's going on there and the primate scandal, the great primate scandal of the 2020s?
So, long story short, so in order to bring drugs to the clinic and test on people, we unfortunately have to test on animals, and there's something called the Animal Welfare Act. So we have to use animal models for that. If we don't prove on an animal model, we cannot bring those drugs to the clinic, let alone commercial. Typically, the rarer the disease, the more you use an NHP, non-human primate, and these are usually small monkeys. There was a little bit in 2022, 2021, where people were using NHPs for not that rare diseases, which I don't like to see, but typically they're reserved for these rare diseases like a Parkinson's or an Alzheimer's or dementia or things like that, where because they're very, very close to, you know, human beings genetically, the data can present strong enough data to enter the clinic at least to try them. So the rule of thumb typically for NHP research is you have to trace the lineage of these monkeys. Like, where did you breed this monkey for research? And so what happened with CRL is that Biden said you couldn't prove these two monkeys, three monkeys did not come from the wild, was really the claim. And so we're putting a full on ban on importing monkeys from Cambodia. And so how that impacts CRL is the price of a monkey goes up a lot, you know, and because it's vital, they won't bring it down, but then it stops clinical research. It stops the ability to go from preclinic to clinic. And that's in my opinion, a very like important national security issue. You're stopping science, you're stopping the pharmaceutical industry from advancing and moving on. And you know, it's tough for us because China, for example, they're going to say, oh, we're not going to import you any monkeys. Like, in fact, Chinese will not import monkeys for medical research to the United States. And they'll are happy to see the United States sort of suffer in that respect. Because
yeah, know how so would I. It is.
Yeah, right. And so if you put a full-on ban on NHP.
First you release the COVID and now you will hold my monkeys. And there goes the monetization of the podcast. Goodbye.
So monkey
breeding, I don't care.
It's been really profitable for CRL. And look, they've come up with other solutions that they've tried as best they can. They pigs, mice, etc. CRL has the biggest models in the world. The deepest amount of models in the world. So it's been I think they'll be okay. It might take a few more quarters to digest, but I think it'll be okay. But long story short, it's like that's another major headwind to biotech as well. Because
so, like, are they not going to get around this monkey thing? They gotta figure out a way to get the monkeys.
I think it's slowly starting to ease, but like eventually they're going to have to.
How quickly can monkeys breed? That's what you got to start figuring out. They gotta have like breeding farms for monkeys.
Yeah, and squirrel has some of that. But again, it's just government getting in the way and stopping science for, you know, a reason that's not great. You know?
Yeah, well, I'm gonna start sending Vuv to the monkeys, man.
The other problem you face
and some Marvin Gaye.
The other problem you have is once the price of the monkey goes up, it's not coming back down.
Yeah.
So
that's like fucking everything. Look at food.
Yeah, because they know like it's so critical. It's incredibly critical to research. And it's like, oh, you're willing to pay now $500,000 for a monkey? All right, yeah, we'll keep it there. You know, and that brings the cost of drugs up. It's just a whole cycle of, you know, inflation, so to speak. So,
well, as you presented, it seems like a very outsized reaction to a. It's very hard to disprove a negative.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Right? So to then say all monkeys are banned because, you know, a couple monkeys we were unable to disprove a negative on is that's tough, man.
Yeah, it's really
so tough. Interesting. So when you're looking at like something like that or that company, I see, you know, trading at 16 times earnings or whatever. Even if it's 30 forward and a lot of those earnings incorporate a lot of the costs that are required to circumnavigate this issue, if you can look 3, 4, 5 years out, should they have a stable supply of monkeys, and should those monkeys go for the current price or more, that may create some interesting earnings power in that business.
Yeah, yeah. And CRL has other tailwinds too, like they're getting into cell and gene therapy manufacturing. You know, they have a safety and assessment business. They have an audit business. They have a bunch of other lines. But just for background for people who might not know, like CRL is the largest CRO in the United States. I think it's in the world. So 85% of all drugs in the United States go through CRL. Meaning,
I've heard this was described to me yesterday as an investment bank for drugs.
Basically,
that's what a CRO is.
Yeah, it's a research org. Like if you and I, you say, hey, we want to start curing some kind of disease, we're going to call it like Bill and Peter Pharma Inc.
We should get a better name.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
I'll refer that to you.
We're
going to raise from VCs, and we're literally going to send it to Charles Rivers. And we're going to say, you guys do the research. You guys do all the data. You tell us what the results are, and then we'll sort of organize it to go to the clinic. And then we'll
What would you say we do here? we're the branding. It's Bill and Peter. Who wouldn't buy from us?
I'm going to let you take care of that one.
I'm telling you, man, I'm coming up with good ideas. I'm trying to come up with an idea for the podcast, but I may just completely switch businesses and go into drug development.
Yeah. That's right.
Foolproof. All right. I didn't mean to deviate. Anyway, Charles River handles everything for us. We're the people.
100% of all neuro drugs go through them.
Okay.
So if you
They take it out and they sell it, right? Because what somebody was saying is they're like the M&A guys. Like they'll pair the people that want to buy the IP with the IP. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So or no?
If they find that, let's say we come up with some kind of drug and we hire them to do the research and the safety and the efficacy and run the trial, and then we find we're kind of running out of cash here, or you know, like maybe it'd be really good if we partnered with Pfizer or Lilly or something like that. They'll help with that as well. They're basically like the de facto research org for the United States, I would say. You know, there's other companies doing that too, like MedPace, but that's more really small, like really really small biotechs. And then there's Thermo starting, has a little bit of that, but not much. CRL sort of like the bigger player
So why are their economics a little bit more defensible if they're more on the research side? Is it that they have good line of sight into how things should be priced, or like what makes those economics of that business interesting long term?
Well, the first is if you can time the cycle well, you can get them at a really attractive multiple. So if you really want to bomb out CRL, it's, you know, cut biotech funding, raise rates to oblivion, you know, ban monkeys, and you probably are at like, okay, 10 times EBITDA kind of situation for S&P 500 component that can compound earnings double digits for forever, effectively.
Why can they, the second part of that statement is why is that defensible, right? The compounding earnings double digits.
It's just like, you know, unless we come up with a cure for every single disease, right? Which that would be a headwind for CRL. And likely if that were to happen, they would probably earn a boatload of cash on the way there, you know.
You can say a shitload. I've got the sticker, parental advisory sticker.
Okay.
Yeah.
The headwind would be like if you somehow come up with a world where you cure every single disease, that would be a headwind.
So what's the bear case? What's a bear going to say on Charles River? Is it basically somebody that's going to be like they're going to miss this quarter? Like how are you long term not constructive on something like this?
Yeah, I think it's tough. If you talk about long term, I think it's tough. I think it's a tough bear case. You could argue that they might, because a lot of their strategy is M&A. You know, they do acquire some smaller bespoke or niche service providers to add on top of their serial services. So you could say maybe they botch an M&A or they pay too much, or the manufacturing business they're developing doesn't go well as well, you know. Maybe it's more of a capital allocation question, but that's probably like from a secular perspective, why it might not do that well. Overly burdened regulations again, like if the next administration goes ham or crazy on you know, overregulating the environment, or biotech funding is in a multi, you know, a decade bear market, then, you know, that might hurt it a little bit. But from a very long perspective, yeah, I don't think there's a super compelling.
I mean, this is going to sound like a naive investor that's never lived through a big drawdown. And I assure you, I may be naive, but I have lived through drawdowns. It seems to me that, God, this sounds so amateur, but I actually believe it. The longer it's hard, the better it's going to be at the end.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like a position, maybe it's like a sizing issue and a portfolio construction question, as opposed to a, you know, whether or not this is at least worthy of a watch list spot.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Look, what's it trading at now? 190? I mean, I think it's a steal at 180.
How's it not? This is not investment advice, but I do have a question, because I've seen this a couple times. People are like, it's a steal 10% lower. And I'm like, well, like, that kind of implies it's a buy here, no?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
Like, if you're gonna park this for 5 to 10 years, like,
yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with you there.
There is a high probability that you're probably not gonna end up in the poorhouse doing things like that on average.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Not investment advice. This is you know, two guys chatting. This is what this is.
That I surely hope that people understand that by now. I think they do. But it's interesting because, you know, I just keep going back to this. It seems to me like you've got real secular tailwinds and a real cyclical puking. And that seems to be not the worst place to fish.
Yeah, I would agree with
right
you.
I mean, Charles River, you could say to me, well, buy it at 10 times earnings, but it's like, okay, like, what are we even talking about? This is basically that company's equivalent, right?
Yeah, you know, people come and ask me about like a Danaher Thermo, I'd be in shit at 12 times earnings, or, you know, 13.
Yeah, then you're never gonna see it, which is fine.
My issue there, it's like, for that to happen, you would need some unbelievable event, like the U.S. government nationalizing Lilly or something like that. You know, you need something tremendously outrageous for that to really, really happen. And just because I think people like mischaracterize the process required in pharma and how unbelievably sticky these companies are and how they're effectively immovable, you know, and this ecosystem is very, very big, right? And some of these companies command not only incredibly high pricing power, but sometimes they get royalties. Like Evotech is another company I like. It's sort of the European equivalent to CRL. EVO is a symbol. And what they do is not only do they help you with drug discovery and have really great tech with AI, et cetera, but if they help you discover something, they'll take a royalty. And they have one drug right now. It's for Bayer's constant cough drug. It's about $1 billion in sales, if they figured. That's like a double-digit royalty. And that's going straight to EBITDA. So these companies have really good unit economics generally across the board. You're going to have like 35, 40% EBITDA margins. And like, how are you going to buy a company at 12 times earnings unless the 10 years at 13% or something crazy and something really wrong has happened in pharma? It's just a tough, tough place to get that greedy, so to speak. And by the way, if that were to happen, don't tell me that you're going to sit there and say, oh, that's a buy. Like, people will be scared. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'm looking at, it looks like CRL, for instance, it doesn't look like it's only one standard deviation outside where it typically trades on a 5-year multiple, but it got very high in 2020. Yeah. I feel like this data is a little bit, needs to be combed a little bit closer to get a truer picture of reality.
Yeah,
because you've got COVID in March of 2020, and then you've got kind of the nonsense of 2021. I go back and forth on that because I've been that person that's been like, oh, I'd be interested at 12 times earnings, and now I realize how flawed that thinking is. And the other thing that I ask myself is, okay, well, if this is trading at 12 times earnings, what, like, I can argue that probably, I mean, to your point, it's either some huge idiosyncratic thing that people just want to avoid the entire sector, or the market has collapsed like 2009. And then it's like, where do you want to be coming out of it? And I think the longer my time horizon gets, the longer I get more intrigued by quality at a reasonable price, as opposed to like really going for deep value, which, you know, can be done in an ETF or something like that. But I'm not trying to buy like my own deep value ideas. I think that's a sucker's game for me to play.
It's hard enough to evaluate quality. And I think people misinterpret this, right? They look at a number and they say, oh, this is a quality company. They look at ROIC or ROE, look at margins, et cetera. They say, that's quality. And sure, today, but you have to sort of take a step back and say, what is the durability of this company? What's the cyclicality of this company? What are the regulations surrounding the company? What's the ecosystem, the profit pool, the competition? What is everything around this company? And why is these metrics defensible or not defensible? And you're going to wrestle with yourself. If you're really rigorous, you're going to wrestle with yourself for a very long time, right? You're going to say, well, you know, maybe this looks quality. He's been doing it for 5 years, but maybe not. I don't know. So I find it useful to talk to people. I find it useful sometimes even to go to industry level conferences to see what's going on, just to get a more comforting sense of like, okay, like this is actually really durable here versus that. And I think it's hard to do that with when you're just looking at a number and, you know, and trying to figure that out. So yeah, I akin picks and shovels to pharma, similar to like a TransDigm, right? The only difference would be like, oh, the FDA says you can't take liftoff without an AmSafe seatbelt. Difference would be in some cases for pharma, imagine they were taking a percentage of every airline ticket on top of that. And so you can have really, really high margin businesses going on for quite a long time, you know?
Yeah.
And the market's littered with companies that have multi-bag to an nth degree from those levels, like Intuitive Surgical, you know, Everett Life Science. I mean, those are more like hospital medical equipment, but like, you know, you have Illumina. Obviously, it's done really poorly lately, but this was like a $2 stock in 2004, right after the tech bubble, 2003. So you have, it's the world where you can see a lot of 10, 20, 100 backers. You know, it wasn't that long ago, Repligen was a money losing microcap. And today it's a future S&P 500 component.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You and Brandon talked about this. I think that's why I think that those stories can get very romanticized and have people focused on microcap. And I think probably the answer comes down to what are you trying to accomplish and what kind of risks are you willing to take on to accomplish that?
Yeah.
It seems to me that letting somebody make the first 20 times and then playing for the next 4 or 5 makes some sense.
Yeah.
And I know how crazy that sounds, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you don't even have to go that crazy. Like West, I think since 2009 has been over 10 bagger. I think it's been a 20 bagger actually. It's an unbelievable run. So you don't have to even go that small in this world because these markets are so big. Like they're so fast. So yeah, it's people often get romanticized with the microcaps, but again, I'm warning everybody, like those are dangerous places to play, especially in the medical field, especially in the healthcare field, especially in the biologics field. Like it's a tougher game to play versus sort of the larger picks and shovels. So.
Well, as someone that just attended a microcaps conference, shout out to Ian Castle.
Yeah.
I left thinking, I like the people that I met in that room are fantastic. I like all you. I don't know if I'm going to play the game you're playing, but
it's tough.
And frankly, I mean, I'm dedicating my time to this in a large way and some other things that game, I think you really got to dedicate yourself to. I mean, all games you do.
So you got to have a really strong stomach. Like there's going to be days where like a NASDAQ's up big, risk on is on and you're down. You know, because like flows and liquidity and like so a lot of people can't handle that. You know,
I don't know that I can handle it, man. I heard you and Bilo talking about it and it sucks because I'm sorry. If you are in a stock and it goes down 50%, I don't care if you think you know it better than everybody. it's human to look in the mirror and be like, I must be missing something here.
100%. Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And you're constantly thinking that.
And it's like, well, I liked it 50% ago. So why the hell would I be right now? Like, clearly it can go down more.
Yeah. And then that, you know, plays into your confidence. That's why holding is so hard, right? Imagine it's down 50 and it stays there for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you sell it and then it just rips 20 times.
Yeah, that's right. You know, yeah, man.
Like, a story as old as time, right?
Yeah. Well, the other thing I like that you guys talked about is how long it takes for these businesses to build, right? And I think, you know, a mistake that I have made is I think that I have accelerated the difference. How do I want to say this? So, like, I saw the planting of seeds and I thought that they would grow into flowers quicker than reality will allow. And, you know, whatever. We'll see if some of those are right or wrong. I know one I was wrong on, which is unfortunate, but whatever. It's interesting to live through.
Yeah, especially in the healthcare space, because you're dealing with highly regulated markets and you can be approved or they can have delay on an approval for some time. Like, it could be 10 years, you know, so for like a window. So after year five, you have like a 10 year window of monopolistic profits. And then all of a sudden it kind of goes away, you know, or something changes or something new has been disrupted. So it's tough, you know, and that's why you'll never see, like,
dude, like, your beeper is blowing up.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's okay.
You'll never see like these mega, mega growth revenues, like, you know, with the AIs where like enterprise tech will move on a dime. It just doesn't work typically in healthcare in the picks and shovels. Typically what you might see is like, if it's a really high growth, it might do 25% for 10, 15 years. You know?
Yeah.
Or maybe it'll be
Design, to your point.
Yeah, by design. Yeah. Just how it's going to be. And so anyone expecting anything else is just fooling themselves. Now, you might have, you know, a couple of years, say, especially in med tech, where it does 50, 60, 70, you know, if procedures are on fire, maybe it's a device for sleep apnea or, you know, for the heart or something like that, you might see that in a short period. But typically these things are more, like in the sort of 20s, 30s for a very long time versus like a triple digits in 2 years kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you want to, I mean, just, you know, we got like 15 minutes or whatever left. I would like for people to understand how you think about portfolio construction, and I will link it in the show notes and we'll continue to direct people. I think that conversation that you had with Brandon is an hour and a half of how you think about markets. So probably more constructive if people want to check that out. But I really appreciate you teaching me today about this ecosystem, and I'm sure my listeners do too.
Yeah. So the way I think about it typically is, and this is always something that's really, really tough, but the way I invest personally is different than how I invest in an LP. And the way I construct things is I typically try to barbell it. So I'll have high expected value. I think of things in the sort of a Mabusin, I'm not sure how you pronounce the name, sort of framework where you have high expected value and then low expected value. So I'll have a barbell of like low expected value stocks with high expected value stocks. And the high expected value stocks are companies that I think are either really high quality, trading at unbelievable valuations, that are facing major tailwinds and secular growth, and that are the right market cap, that I think could be major sort of have high IRRs. You know, I'll weight that, let's say 30%, 40%, and then I'll have a lower expected value at like 70, 60, let's say, percent. And lower expected value can do really well. It can streamline the portfolio in bad years. It could zig while the other stuff zags, so to speak. And I just like to think of it sort of like that, where, you know,
when you say lower expected value, what do you mean?
Like, if you think,
because I would think you would overweight lower expected value, which is, or yeah, underweight it rather, which is why I wanted to have you just kind of,
it depends,
like, double click on that.
Like, if you have something like a Thermo where you kind of know what the IRR is going to be from an earnings perspective, from a multiples perspective, let's say, you know, this thing might do 10 to 15% a year for a really, really, really long time. That's a low expected value stock, right?
Low expected return maybe is
lower, yeah.
Yes.
But
yes,
like, if you have, you know, another company that's also integral in the profit pool that is trading at 1x EV to sales, for example, laying the framework for the ecosystem that's going to flounder and all of a sudden goes from like 200 million market cap to, you know, 2 billion, right? As that profit pool sort of emerges, that's always a high expected value. So, but the problem you have is, well, as this company might be laying down the seeds or the rails for the ecosystem, it could take a long time and it could, you know, not move or move down when the market's up, et cetera. Whereas if you have something like a Thermo, it'll sort of streamline things. Like you kind of know where this thing's going to move when the market's doing. If the market's down, it's probably going to be down typically, right? Or if the market's up, it's going to be up. And if you buy at a good price, you can outperform the market, right? Especially with like a good Thermo Fisher, high quality. So having those in the portfolio, I think, is important. Is important. You know, we use a little bit of leverage to that as well, just to get a little extra juice. But that's how we like to frame it, so that we, you know, streamline things. And also the other aspect too is you might have a low expected value stock, and if you think the higher expected value company might take 3 years to sort of work out, well, by then that low expected value stock might have run, right? It's no longer 200 stock; it's like 600 or 500. Yep. Or whatever. So. Yeah, that's how we try to balance everything in the port.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm characterizing what Acri's firm said correctly when they were asked why they don't sell some of the things that run, and they were like, "Look, like these stocks don't get cheap that often, and you might sell it because you think it's you may sell it because you think it's rich, and it just gets richer and richer, and you don't get to touch it again. And if it's a business that you truly want to like own long term." You're probably incurring more costs than it's worth to try to trade around those types of positions.
Yeah, it definitely. Especially now when like valuations have come down a lot and, you know, we're in a transition mode, so to speak, for the entire sector or just for the markets in general. You know, it's tough to trade around it, constantly incur taxes when could be missing, could be making a mistake, and it's probably just better just to hold on and go from there, right?
So. Well, it's going to be an interesting time, man. I don't know if it's small caps. I got somebody that's going to come on and talk about REITs. We got biotech. I mean, there are bioprocessing, I should say. Like, there's just so many. Look, the people that own the index, I really commend you because you have no idea how much carnage is underneath.
It's crazy.
And people are feeling a ton of pain. Now, whether or not the Mag 7 or whatever can skate through it unscathed, I have no idea. I think the longer I watch it happen, the higher probability I think it actually they will go through unscathed. But at some point, the gap I think has to close.
Yeah, look, I don't want to take anything away from those companies. Like they are theoretically some of the greatest companies to ever exist in the history of capitalism, right? And they've all come from the United States, and these are crown jewels for U.S. economy and global economy. But this does definitely feel like, you know, sort of 2002 or 2000, you know, like that kind of period where you've had absolute unbelievable carnage in a lot of these companies, like the small cap, quality, high growth small caps, let's say, or micro caps. Even some mid caps, even the other parts of the S&P, but like for some reason, Cisco's still trading at like, you know, 25, 40 times earnings, or, you know, JDS Uniphase is still expensive. You know, like this is that, it gives that kind of vibe where, you know, the unit economics for a lot of those companies were also really strong, right? In 2000, 2001, 2002, they were higher ROIC companies. And, you know, obviously there's some level of durability to Microsoft and Amazon. I'm not even comparing those two to, you know, a Cisco back in 2000. But I just don't know how you get the IRRs that you would have gotten in 2009 or 2010 at these multiples today. Now, if they come down, they'd be more interesting. You know, there
Holy
is a
shit. Dude, Cisco was a $448 billion company on, I guess, $18 billion in sales, $19 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say that out loud, there's some companies around today that are similar. $5 billion in cash flow. So, whoa.
Was that in...
Anyway.
Or is that in 2001?
I guess 729,000 is when I have that.
Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting. The free cash flow there kind of followed through, right? I mean, you grew from 5 billion in free cash to 11 billion. You know, starting in 2008, it looks like they started to harvest cash flow. You weren't wrong on the durability and you weren't wrong on the cash flow necessarily. Yeah. The valuation just did not allow for much to go wrong.
Yeah.
Relative to the price paid.
That's kind of a risky take with the Mag 7, in my opinion, the Mag 7. And, you know, there is a world where, like, the index fall, the Mag 7 falls, and, like, some of these small microcaps are, like, slightly green on the day. Or they're, like, not as down that much. You know, there is that world where it's like, okay, there's, like, a real cycle refresh here. You know?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the guys that I talked to that were around in 2000 remember that world very well. Which, this is not that. You know, right? I mean, these are, I do think that these valuations are certainly defendable. But I'll tell you what, if you were in 2000, people would have been, I bet if this podcast existed in 2000, I'd probably be saying the same thing about Cisco. As much as I don't want to admit it, I think that narratives are strong and you can say, hey, well, I see why. And I said I said it before on Value After Hours. I was like, look, you know, the crazy basket. I was like, look, as a basket, I don't like it, but some of these will work. But I have no ideas which ones.
Yeah.
But I do think these valuation bands are getting crazy stretched.
Yeah. And like the 10 years above 4.5, like it doesn't, I don't know if you saw what happened to utilities yesterday. Down 5%.
Yeah, they just got shellacked. I did see that.
And if you look at some of the microcaps, like today, the Dow's down 200, and some of these microcaps are green right now. So
I don't believe you.
You could.
I'm going to go Ron Burgundy and say I don't believe you.
There's nobody left to sell, right? I think I tweeted that the other day or yesterday.
Yeah, it's the one lone guy that's like, I am not selling you my shares down.
Right, that's right. That's where you're at. That's where you're at.
Yeah. What'd you say? There's no more blood in the streets. There's just no one in the streets.
Yeah. That's right. That's where you're getting at. So.
Yeah. That's wild. Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. And I thank you for your contribution to Twitter. It's been fun to jump into the quality spaces and listen to you guys riff. I think it's opened my eyes. Yeah, it is. I love doing this. I got to figure out, you know, what I'm going to do with it, but I love doing it. And I think people enjoy me doing it. So, well, I know that. Shout out to the 600 of you that I'm the most listened to. I love you guys. So I don't know. We'll see, man. It's been a hell of an experience. I wouldn't know you otherwise.
I know. What a shame that would have been. You know?
Well, I've enjoyed it. So I look forward to many more conversations in the future.
Yeah, for sure. And always happy to connect and chat stuff. So look forward to chatting in the future.
All right. Good deal, man. Thank you very much for stopping by. I think this is going to be the first episode of the season. So welcome back, I guess. Yeah.
Let's go. Yeah,
so let's go indeed. All right. Have a good one. And thanks again.
For sure. Same to you. Absolutely necessary.